Into a church you've not been in before and trying to get the furniture arranged the way you like it. And I want a board, and if at the back you can't read what I'm going to stick along the board, then you might want to look move forward. People I know like to sit at the front of the bus, so just imagine this is a bus. And you know, go for the front seats, right behind the driver. You'll feel more comfortable there, you'll see more, and let's do it that way. And if you've got long sight, you can see my wee papers right from the back. Well, if you want to sit in the back row of the bus, that's fine. You've had, well, maybe before I talk about what I'm going to talk about, tell you just a little bit about Margaret and myself. We've been with Wycliffe Bible Translators for a long number of years. We went to Ethiopia first in 1975. And that was quite young at that time, and I'm not quite so young now. And we've worked in Ethiopia and in Kenya, and in recent years we've roved around Africa a little bit more than that, and worked with translators in different places. They do the translation, and we come along and try to help them do a quality check on it, because after they do the work, they really can't see too many problems. They struggled hard. They did their best. It's okay now. And our job has been to come along and try to help them see where it might be weaker than they imagined and where they might improve it, and try to help them improve it as we go. And the kind of thing I'm going to do tonight is heavily influenced by what I do with translators in Africa when we would be talking about Exodus together and checking through Exodus. I'll need to go a lot faster with you than I would with translators. I would take time, we'd do just several chapters a day. We'd be talking all day, the whole day from breakfast time to dinner time. And I won't be able to do that, although you have left me plenty of time, singing group, thank you. Well, I've done what I can to get you to move, and nobody shifted at all. And there you go, that's what life's like. You've had several talks. You've had one on the covenant in Exodus. You've had one on the instructions for the tabernacle, as it's being called, I think, in your outlines. And you've had a talk on the instructions also for making clothing, suitable clothing for the priests, and consecrating them so that they can serve in that tabernacle. Way back then in the time of Moses, something like maybe 1,500 years BC is the way the book is set. And these talks have emphasized a kind of New Testament interpretation on what's going on. And what I've got to do tonight is try to cover the making of the tabernacle. After all the instructions about it, cover the making of it in not quite the last five chapters of Exodus. And what I want to do is spend quite a bit of time with a big brush, putting in some of the big strokes, the journey that the people have been coming through as they have been at Mount Sinai. And this is going to be the first part. And I'm sure you can read that from the back. Not everything will be as good as that, let me tell you. God's taking the people from slavery in Egypt in a journey, first to the mountain, Sinai, to make a covenant with them, then on to a land that he's going to give them for themselves. And this tabernacle, as it's been called in English translations, goes with them. It's God's moving house. He's in a mobile home, and he's going with them. It's very similar to other portable shrines in the ancient world, the ancient Near East. Very similar in the way it's done, with God right in the center of it, right in the heart of it, and the priests approaching to it, and the people further off than the priests. So the pattern's very familiar to them, not to us. Also familiar to them is the fact that most temples were built facing the rising sun, so that when you entered, you're entering with the rising sun at your back and going into the presence of your God, whichever God you think that might be. Exodus takes a lot of chapters to do this, doesn't it? So God's obviously being very meticulous, very fastidious in what he's trying to do. And the first thing he does, going back through chapters that you've already been working with, the first thing he does is make a covenant with them. And in that covenant, he, first of all, chapter 19, can you still see that? You can read that at the back, can you? I know that I couldn't. In the first one, he proposes a covenant and accepts it. I've got to go really, really quite fast to get through these chapters. We need to move the slides forwards. All right, and this is them at the mountain here, after they've come out of Egypt. And another slide in chapter 19. We don't have time to read all of it, but look at the words that I've bolded there. If you obey me fully and keep my covenant. So he's actually proposing a covenant here. The if we should understand is an offer. He's making an offer to them. I'll make a covenant with you. If you accept the covenant, then there will be consequences for that. Now, they knew that. They knew exactly what a covenant was. They were familiar with it in the ancient world. It's not a word that we're terribly familiar with outside of maybe church meetings like this. But they knew what that word was. I'll make a covenant. You will obey and keep the covenant. Let's move on to the next slide, where you see right there in chapter 19, the people all responded together, we'll do everything the Lord has said. So he makes his offer, and they make their response. And the response is positive, affirmative, we'll do it. So they're moving into covenant with him. And let's go to the next slide. And here's what a covenant is. It's not as simple as our promises. It's more than that. It's set up between two parties. And in some ways, so is a promise. But it really is between two parties, and both parties play their part. Okay? It's a relational thing. If you come into a covenant, you're in relationship with the other party. The other party is in relationship with you. And that could be between individuals, or it could be between communities who maybe were at war and now are struggling to find peace, or it could be between two nations. In this case, and this is unique in our world, God is making a covenant with a group of human people. No other God has ever done that. This is absolutely unique in the story of Exodus, that God decides you make a... He's bringing himself into relationship with them, and he's bringing them into a relationship with him. And it's two parties, and they will have mutual obligations to each other, as you see there. Both sides have obligations. And that makes it different from a promise, doesn't it? Where only one side makes the commitment, and the other side just receives the good things. Both sides take up obligations towards the other. And each side has expectations of the other, that these obligations will be met. Okay, the covenants usually are ratified. They're brought into force at some particular point, in some particular way. They're often documented, maybe chiseled on stone, or scraped on skin, ink on skin, or whatever. They can be just pillars of stone or a cairn like Laban and Jacob raised to signify their covenant. And the copies of these terms are usually shared between the two parties. Next slide. I'm going on to the next chapter, and that's a long, slow one, what we've just done. Huh? The beginning of chapter 20 is the 10 words of the covenant. The Ten Commandments, as we're familiar with there. And it's a kind of preamble to the covenant. It's the 10 headings that God's going to pursue with the people. It's like a 10-heading sermon in that sense. Okay, so it's the 10 headings of the covenant. And Moses gets two stones with that on the stones, doesn't he? And the next three chapters are expanding on the words of the covenant. If you take time to look at it, and maybe you have in recent weeks, I urge you to read Exodus if you haven't done so. There, chapter 20 to chapter 23, roughly, he expands the Ten Commandments. And he starts, blow me, with altars. He talks first about altars. And he ends his discussion by talking about Sabbath and other festivals. So he's getting his own side in, beginning and end, and it's like a giant panini. In the middle is everything else that people have to do. And it's all their social obligations to each other in the community of Israel and to others surrounding the community of Israel. More words of covenant that right there in those chapters. And it's one of the boring things to read, isn't it, in Exodus? We're out of the nice stories and we're into these, we sometimes call them laws. They're not laws, they're guidance for the covenant. He's telling the people how he wants them to be in covenant. That goes down to late in chapter 23. And I think we're on another slide now. And in this part of chapter 23, he spells out some of his obligations to the people. Now they're moving towards covenant. Okay, they'll come into relationship. He's made clear some of his demands on them. He's now making clear his obligations to them. And you see what he's doing. He's going to send an angel or a messenger with the same word. And you've got to watch out what he's saying and doing because my name is in him. Huh? But let's look forward to the next bit. When they get into the land, little by little, I drive out your enemies before you until you have increased enough to take possession of the land. Did you notice I didn't draw attention back in chapter 19 when he's beginning to make the covenant? He said, all the earth is mine. Right? That's the God who's making covenant. All the earth is mine. And here he's saying, I'm going to give you the land. So he's giving what's his. And he's bringing them in to be tenants in his land. It's the Lord's land he's bringing them into. That's what he's saying in the chapter there. And he's going to make that part of his obligation to them, that he'll bring them in and give them possession way back there in the time of Moses to that land. I'm standing in the way of it. And then just a wee warning at the end there, don't make a covenant with any of the other nations round about. You've got one covenant. And it's with me, and that's enough. Chapter 24 ratifies that covenant, and we're going to look at some of the verses there, so let's move to another slide. You know chapter 24, the Lord calls Moses and these other men and 70 elders up into the mountain, and he goes up and Moses tells the people all the Lord's words and laws, right? He's reading out the terms of the covenant to them. He reads it aloud in this chapter so that they all understand what they're getting into. And they responded again with one voice, everything the Lord said, we'll do. That's confidence for you, isn't it? We know their history and we know our own history. And it's not as easy as that, but there, that's what the people say there. And Moses wrote down everything the Lord had said. And in that chapter, it immediately goes on to talk about the book of the covenant. So in some form, what he wrote down was a book of the covenant. I don't know whether it would be leather skins maybe or whatever, but there you go. Let's go to the next slide. And they got up the next morning and started up the mountain. And you see what he does. First an altar, then pillars or standing stones. We're used to standing stones in UK from the ancient world. He set up some standing stones. Some pillars. And throughout the Old Testament, you'll find pillars set up as memorials in various ways. And he sent some young men and they sacrificed offerings. And Moses took some of the blood and splashed it against the altar. Then he took the Book of the Covenant. Here he comes in already, takes the Book of the Covenant, reads it to the people. They respond, again, we'll do everything the Lord has said. We will obey. Do you see how God's pushing them into this relationship, and they're responding willingly. They're affirming that they will keep and obey. So next slide. That's right. He sprinkles the blood now on the people, at least the 70 elders, the representatives of the people. This is the blood of the covenant. We know these words, don't we, even as Christians? This is the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. It's ratification. He's bringing it into force. They're going to be in covenant now, very, very soon. And there's no way back out. When you're in relationship in covenant, all you can do is break it and run. There's really no other way to get out. And so he does this, the blood of the covenant. That's where the phrase, of course, comes from that we use so regularly in communion. And this bit, next bit's nice too. These elders, I don't know what it means. They saw the God of Israel. They saw God and they ate and drank. Covenant meal. Okay, they're up in the mountain. They see God. They're with God. And they have a meal together. Because that's how you ratify covenants. You eat together. You're now in relationship. This is what God's been doing in these chapters there. From a proposal that's accepted, he works through right to ratifying the covenant. Is there any more in chapter 24? Is the next one in 24? Yeah, there it is. I'll give you tablets of stone with the long commandments I've written for their instruction. Note it and we'll pass. Next slide. And then I'm going to quickly review, even more quickly, I think, than that, quickly review the instructions, as your talk called them. Oh, and I didn't say anything about cutting. The Hebrew expression for making a covenant is cutting a covenant. It's like our expression, cutting a deal. Okay? And cutting a deal means that two parties agree over something. They reach an agreement. They've cut a deal. God, or Hebrew, cuts a covenant. Okay? Same idea. And just as hard to explain as cutting a deal. Why should you cut a deal? For the same reason you cut a covenant. It's just the way we speak. Right, let's go quickly through the how to make it. And this is really a review still. And now you know why I asked them to move all the furniture. This is still review, and we'll get through this as fast as we can also. And how to make it starts in chapter 25. And it starts by God calling for contributions from his people, they're now his people. He calls for contributions, all the materials that are going to be needed to do something. He calls for the contributions and he spells out the task. Are we on? Yes, we're on these verses. Okay, bring me a contribution. You're keeping up with me. Thank you. That's good. And he lists them all in very small print. It's too small for you to read. And then he says the second thing, tell them to bring a contribution. Tell them to make a sanctuary for me. And the third thing, tell them to make it exactly the way I tell you to. You see, these three things, they're all the same. Tell the Israelites, one, two, three. I'm going to look at the third one because it's the most interesting one. Tell the people to make a sanctuary for me. I want to live among them. I want to live among them. That's staggering. To my knowledge, no other God in any other country, in any other nation, has ever said, I want to live with my people. They should come and worship. They should come and bring their gifts. But the God of Israel is the only one who said, I want to live with the people. So I want you to make a place for me. The word sanctuary, sometimes it's translated holy place. It's one Hebrew word. You don't need to know what it is. The word dwell, you do need to know what it is. Dwell, it's lodge. It's not totally permanent. But it's not bed and breakfast either. It's a longish time, but he'll be moving. He's not there forever. God isn't locked into Mount Sinai where they build this tabernacle. And the word for dwell, you're all of an age to know the word Shekinah or Shekinah. You've all heard that in your early years. I did in my early years. It's the word Shekan. I want to dwell with my people. And the place where he'll dwell is a Mishkan. And that's what Israel calls it to this day. And that's why I've put up the word Mishkan. If you hunt for Mishkan in Google, it'll turn up the tabernacle in Exodus. It'll turn up the big model one, full-size model in the south of Israel there. I want to lodge with the people. He's not a temporary come-and-go lodger. He's not a permanent one that you know, he's there whatever happens. It's this middle term thing. If the people keep the covenant, I'll be with the people. Let's take the next slide there. And he goes immediately. Now he's getting into the instructions, which I'm calling how to make. He goes immediately. Whoops, it's all fallen. Goes immediately to how to make this covenant chest thing. How to make a covenant chest. First thing he asks them to do is that. And the next slides, we're on it, are we? I just need to gather up my papers. I don't like being far away from you back there. I'm really bad thing. If you won't move, I will. Have to make it, called in the Bible, an ark. It's a box, huh? The covenant chest. It's an open chest. The lid is totally separate, lies on top. You know what it's like. You've read that, and it tells them the size. And into the covenant chest, you'll put the tablets of the covenant law, which I give you. Again, just keep that in your mind too. Huh? Interesting that he starts with that one. Huh? But you see it now. He's made a covenant, and the first piece of furniture he wants in his home is a chest that represents the covenant. That's why it comes first. He's made a covenant, and now that comes absolutely central in his home. Huh? It's the most inner place you can get. There's no more inner place than where that chest will be. You know that from what you know already about the tabernacle. The inside room, that's where it will be. It's the only thing that's there, and it marks the covenant. And he's telling the people to put the tablets of the law inside that, and you're going to hang on to that in your mind. We're ready for the next one? Next thing he asks is a table for holding bread. Yeah, you really have to ask, what's in God's mind? Why do we need a table? Hang on to the question. We're going to get it when we build the tabernacle. Eh? And after that, I'm not going to say any more about that table. After that, a special kind of lampstand with seven lamps on the top of it. And this is all inside. His home, the tent, the Mishkan. So he started right at the center, right at the heart, and he's working out, right? Because he starts with the covenant. Everything rests on that. You don't have a covenant, you don't have God living with you. And this is where he's starting. This is what Exodus is trying to do for us. He's moving out from the inmost place, out through the next part, where there'll be a table for bread, and there'll be a lampstand. And only then does he get to the tent. Interesting that it's in that order. It's organized. This is not accidental, is it? This is organized. This is God working out from himself, his perspective on coming to live with the people there. And after that, I'm going to have to put it down, and you might have to get a periscope if you want to see it. After that, outside the tent, you get the bronze altar. That will be for sacrifice. That's in the semi-public place that lots of priests can get into. And then around the bronze altar, there's a courtyard, a space, still a sacred space, still a holy space, but it's screened off. And you know about that too, huh? Absolutely like all shrines and temples in the ancient world there. And he gets to that point, screen, and then, oops, start talking about oil for the lamp. You would think you've done that several paragraphs ago, wouldn't you? No, but this changes pace. This is not furniture. And so it breaks, and everybody who reads it says, oh, it's changed. There's a jerk here in the story, in the telling of instructions. And right after that jerk, two long chapters that start the second half of the instructions. The second half of the instructions are not furniture, but people who function in the tent, in the Mishkan. So he's turned his attention now away from things that will be in it to people who will go into it. And he spends two whole chapters, as you knew. Was it just last week you did this? Yeah? So it's still right there in the front of your mind, isn't it? Eh? And he does with the priests there in 28, 29. We must have moved on. What's the next one? Yeah, move back till I get that. Sorry, I missed a bit. He's still back there. I should have said that when we were talking about the Ark of the Covenant chest, where he says, I've put it in bold. I'll meet with you there. I mean, this is staggering. We've got so familiar with it. God says, I'll meet with you there. And from above the lid, it's translated there, mercy seat. We'll talk about that later if there's time. From between the two cherubim, wherever they are, and there won't be time to talk about that, that are on the Ark of the Testimony. You see how it's now called Ark of the Testimony? You get both names, keep in your mind. I'll speak with you. And this is what you're doing Exodus for, isn't it? A God who reveals himself. And this God's revealing himself by saying, I want to live with my people. And to do that, I've got to have a covenant with them. We've got to be in relationship. And when we get that relationship sorted out, then we'll have a covenant chest in which the two tablets of law will be put. And from then on, I'm going to live in a tent that you're going to build for me. And so he goes on. And that's at the end. That's back in 25. So now we do go on. I'm sorry, I forgot that. And skip the next one. Just go straight on. That's the first part. Keep going. We've covered all that on the board there. We've got out past the lamp oil. Next one too. We've got the priest clothing and how to consecrate the priests. And the next one is at the end of consecrating the priests. And it's just a how-to. Okay? They're not doing it. They're just, he's telling Moses how to do it. Okay, and look at what it says there, where he repeats again at the tent of meeting. So now you've got three names for this place. It's a sanctuary, it's a Mishkan, a tabernacle, and it's a tent of meeting. Okay? A place of appointment. It's the waiting room. It's where we come to approach God. Third name for it. There I will meet with the Israelites, and the place will be consecrated by my glory. Okay? And then it goes on, I will consecrate the tent. Now, he's just spent a chapter telling Moses how to consecrate everything and everyone. And there's going to be oil, and there's going to be blood, and there's all kinds of rituals going on to consecrate them for their work in the tabernacle. And then he says at the end, I'll consecrate it. Whatever we can do to consecrate is only temporary. It's only secondary. It's only a reflection of the fact that he does the consecration because he's the Holy One of Israel. You see the way the thing's developing there? Oh, well, this is the second half of the preparation. And it's the incense altar. He does that. And he's gone back inside again, hasn't he? Do you know where the incense altar is? It's just outside the covenant chest, just in front of it, somewhere with the table for bread and the lampstand. So he's moved back inside, and he's starting out again. But the very next thing he does is introduce a levy, a poll tax, if you like, that everyone has to pay occasionally. I'm going to leave that. I'm going to come back to it in a minute. Because the next thing he goes on to is some kind of a big cistern between the tent and the altar for washing. Okay, it doesn't tell us much about, it doesn't tell us the sizes this time. We've got to imagine that. And everybody's imagined different kinds of sizes there. And I'm going to come back to that too. And then he does the anointing oil and the incense. You'd have thought, well, you could have done that earlier. No, he's laying it out according to a plan. When a priest comes in, makes sacrifices for sure, but he's got to come in somehow with the community giving incense, somehow with the community providing anointing oil. And before he goes into the incense altar in the tent, he's got to wash. Whatever else he does at the other altar, here it's here, whatever else he does, he's got to wash hands and feet. And between washing and getting into the tent, God says, oh, by the way you will pay for the oil and the incense is that we're going to have a wee tithes, a poll tithes. From time to time, everybody's going to pay a small sum of money. It's just about the weight of a 20p piece. 20p piece, a little bit lighter than what they are asked to give in the levy. Eh? But they were giving silver, not whatever this is. It's not silver. So they're being asked, everyone, every adult, to give a little tithe. That'll supply the anointing oil and the incense so that when he goes to wash, he's got these with him. So when he goes into the altar, he can take these things. He needs to attend to the lamp. He needs to attend to the incense altar. And every week he's taking in fresh bread. Oh, I'm running out of space here. He's not finished yet. This is still the how to make. Starts with calling for gifts from the people. And near the end, he says, I'm going to provide the craftsmen. I'm going to give people the skill they need to do this. Right? You remember that in the verses. And then, believe it or not, he ends up talking about the Sabbath. It's not the first time in Exodus he's talked about the Sabbath. See, you've got all this stuff to do. I still want you to rest. I still want you to take a day a week and not work. Not work. I rest, you rest. Don't let the work overcome your need for rest, for worship, for family, for community, and so forth. Well, that took longer than I thought it would, how to make it. I've gone through it. I've given you, I hope, a reasonably alive picture in your memory there for that. And now we're on to actually making it. And in the making of it, there's some other things to see. It's still organized. Between the how to do it and the doing of it, there's these chapters that I think you're going to speak on next week when Moses comes down from the mountain. He finds the people are having a party and dancing. That's not the worst of it. They're committing idolatry. He's just made a covenant. Within the last 40 days, within a month, let's say. And everything you do, we'll obey, we'll follow. And Moses is away for a month and he comes back and finds they're already worshipping idols. Eh? They've broken the covenant. It's hardly started. They've broken it. What does he do? Bringing down his two stones, smashes the stones. They've broken the covenant, break the stones. No covenant now. You're out of covenant. You know these chapters. You'll deal with them next week. I don't want to spoil his thunder, whoever it is doing it. They have to make new tablets of law and renew the covenant We'll see about it next week, huh? And it's after that, the actual making, the mishkan, the lodging place. And blow me, does he not start again by talking about Sabbath? So, as you said about making it, it doesn't override the need to worship, the need to rest, the need to be with your family, with your community. Nothing overrides that. And then there's a long passage about giving gifts. So you're kind of keeping us up there. You're doing great. Okay, and then he is, he talks about the giving of the gifts again. He talks about the craftsmen again. I'm really going to need to pass by. And then the making of it, this is where I want to get. When we're talking about the making of it, we're looking at the people's perspective. And they start with the tent. They start with the tent, and there it is. Full size, you could walk into that. It's not holy, because God isn't living there right now. Huh? But that's the tent down in southern Israel there. What's the next slide like? Okay. In the tent, first of all, for sure, the covenant chest. And there's a kind of a replica of what they think it might be like. And in the covenant chest, they were to put the two tablets of the law. And here they are here. So Moses comes down, goes up to the covenant chest, puts these inside. They're written on both sides. It's not the Hebrew script that you're used to. This is the old script. Like, you know, you owe the English marmalade. Do you remember that script? This is the old one. Two pieces of stone with 10 words written on both sides. That's not the way you usually see it in our pictures. You usually see one stone with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the other stone with 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. But no, it's two stones written on both sides with all 10 words. Why? They go into the chest. You can go to the next slide. Okay, here's the two stones. Jump on. I've talked about that. They put the stones in the Ark of the Testimony. They are the testimony. They're the witness to the covenant. That's why it's called that. The witness to the covenant. Next slide. And you can just see two stones lying in that replica one. There's two other things that we don't even have time to mention, but the stones are in there. Why? Because when the people pick up the poles and walk around from camp to camp, they've got their receipt of the covenant and they've got God's receipt of the covenant. Two complete receipts of the Ten Commandments. One's God's, one's theirs. If God really wanted to carry his own, he'd carry his own. Huh? But he makes them do all the carrying, and they will both be the same, and there should be no alteration. Look at that. Look at that. I should have chiseled it out like Moses did, shouldn't I? Not get into a mess with all the color. Well, that's the covenant chest. Next, it comes to the bread table. We'll talk a little bit about that. There we have it inside that model one. It's really a life-size one. You've got enough room in here for three of those. Okay, three sanctuaries, three tents, three mishkan. No wider, less than half the width of the church, eh? And certainly less than its length, just about the seated area, maybe to about here. And don't worry about the priests who got in there. You see the bread table on the right. You see the candlestick on the left. You see the incense altar outside the screen. And we've already been inside and had a look at the covenant box because that's central. That's covenant. That's why the two stones with the Ten Commandments are there. And where did I put my papers? Why a bread table? The Jewish prayer before meals, says, "You are blessed, King of the universe, for bringing forth bread from the earth." They say that repeatedly before meals. We give thanks and say grace also before meals. That's theirs. you are blessed, King of the universe, for bringing forth bread from the earth. Right there in the tabernacle is the token, the symbol that God is still providing food for his people. The rain comes in its season. The sun comes in its season. The seed grows and sprouts, and we don't know how, and produces a crop from which we can make food. And it's right there in the tent. So every week when they go in and replace the old stuff with new, they are saying, it's God who supplies our bread. Thank you, Lord, for your supply. The lampstand. That lampstand of Israel has become very well known, hasn't it? Even though its name, don't you? Menorah. The light stand, the lampstand itself. People have puzzled for a long time. Where did you ever think up a design like that? Never mind that God told them when it should be light. Where did this design ever come from? So the next slide, this is a plant that grows in just that region of the Middle East. Isn't that astonishingly similar? And it's now believed that that plant, salvia, it's a salvia, that is the model for the lampstand. You can always believe that, can't you? I just see it. What are they saying with the lamp? Well, it's the only source of light. You wouldn't be able to see your way in that tent if you didn't have the lamp. What are you saying? God's the only source of genuine light. Take him out of life and we're in darkness. And do we not see something about that in our society today? Without light, people stumble around in darkness. They can all disagree with each other. They can all live with whatever freedom they want to have. Eventually, the darkness catches up. The only light in the tabernacle was the seven lamps of the lampstand. And I've even got some of them for you too tonight. So Aaron will go in with his wee pot of oil. I think it was a gold pot, not a clay pot. Huh? And he would go in with his wee lamps. You unwrap one. And they would be gold too. Morning and evening, you would clean the wick or stick a new wick in. You would pour in some oil. It's got a wick in it, huh? You see the little thing? And it would sit one on top of each lampstand. His job in the morning, in the evening, would be to go and clean up the wick, replace the oil, and make sure all seven were alight, because God is the light. Father of lights, the Bible calls him. You just pass them around, they'll get them at the end. So when they're making it, the next thing they make is the bronze altar. And then after that, the cistern. It only gets one verse, the cistern. All right, be Aaron. There's the cistern there. Huh? You can see roughly the size of it. Wash your hands like a priest. Come on, demonstrate it. How do you wash your hands? Where did you get the water? It's in the cistern. So how did you get it? In the morning, somebody brings in big water pots, fills it up, fresh running water, fills it up for the day's activities. Eh? What does a priest do? I've seen them, visitors, do it, putting their hands down in the water. Washing their hands down there, like it's a wash basin. That's not how Jews wash their hands. That's not how anybody in Africa washes their hands. Somebody pours the water over your hands. And you wash in running water. And you know running water works in the New Testament.
rivers of living water. You don't put your hands in the basin. That's for containing it. You scoop it out in a jug and you pour it over your hands. Someone else does that for you and you wash them. Same with the feet. Sit in a wee stool and someone pours water over your feet. Remember that when Jesus is washing the feet of his disciples, eh? Usually says in a basin. We all imagine them all sticking their feet in the basin. And you would like to be the first disciple, not the last one, to put your feet in the basin. Huh? No, they didn't do it that way. If it's a basin, then it's to catch the running water that he's pouring. Or it's a pitcher. And we're not told about the basin. Either way, he's pouring running water over their feet. Certainly in the tabernacle, a priest is having water, fresh running water poured over his hands before he will enter the tent. The water runs down the way, and then the water runs off the wrists. Huh? They're careful about that. It's running water. You don't put your hands into the water. That just makes it dirty for everybody else who follows you. You take the water out and do it. Okay, I've spent more than long enough on that. Have I got any papers left? And we're back, last of all, to the screen. People are making all these things. And then they make the screen. And nearly every man, woman, and child of Israel is outside the screen. Huh? They can approach the entrance if they're bringing a gift, an offering, a sacrifice. They may even, some of them, be inside the entrance, giving it over, handing it over to the priest. But mostly, they're outside the screen. It's too high to see over. It's about this height. You can't peek in on God. If you want to approach him, there's a way to do that. And there are lessons there for us, huh? Definitely lessons there for us. He wants to live among us. But we can't treat him like our next door neighbor. We can't do that. If he's God and I'm human, how on earth do I behave that I can approach him successfully, be received successfully? And there's a whole story in there that you can expand on. Screen, have I got anything else left? Yeah, I've got one or two. Because they're not finished yet. The Old Testament loves lists. So they produce a list of everything they used making the tabernacle. It's their accountability. The craftsmen make a list of everything they used. And they had used a lot. They had gathered flax and spun linen thread, I guess the women. They had woven that linen thread into long curtains, drapes for making the tent. They had dyed it. I guess that's all work for the women. They had slaughtered animals, taken the skins, scraped the skins clean, both sides, hair off and fat off from the inside. They had tanned or cured the skins. They'd stitched them together to make another covering for them. A lot of work and a lot of materials. And so they produced a list to show that those gifts that were brought were properly accounted for. Nobody took some of the linen home and made a dress for his wife. That's just the tent. They have to go on to the priest's clothes. And we're not going to look at it. There's another chapter there. And then a summary of all the work. We're going to look at some of that there. That one. This is the conclusion of making it. And I've tried to do both parts tonight very, very quickly. All the work on the Mishkan, the tent of meeting. Yeah? I'll give you the Hebrew for that. Was completed. They did everything. The Israelites did everything just as the Lord commanded Moses. I didn't need to say it's already written there. And they brought everything to Moses. Can you just imagine in your mind? They had done it all. I don't know where they were working. They brought it all together to Moses, listing all the stuff they had made there in small print.
the Israelites had done all the work just as the Lord had commanded Moses. They've already broken the covenant, it's already been renewed, but they have made a Mishkan, a dwelling place, a lodging for God to be among the people of Israel. Next slide. I think it's about the last one. Eh? Moses inspected the work, and behold, they had done it just as the Lord had commanded them. That's a wonderful sentence, isn't it? And I've put in there after, behold, the Hebrew. Okay, because what it's saying there, it's not the storyteller. He's writing the first bit. Moses inspected the work. And then he switches and tells you what Moses had in his mind as he looked at it. They've done it just as the Lord said. That's his thoughts. And that's what that little funny Hebrew word in there is saying. Very often translated just as, and behold. Huh? And what it's saying is, switch point of view. Now you're in Moses' head. You're being told what he thinks. Happens back in Genesis 1, God looked at everything he had made and behold, same word, it is very good. There you're hearing God's opinion about his own creation. Not Moses' opinion writing it in a book. That comes later. What you're hearing is God looked at everything he had made and behold, it's very good. That's his opinion about his work. Here you have Moses' opinion about the Israelites' work, making this lodging place for God to be in the midst of the people. Well, I've run out of time. I don't have time to carry that forward and apply it in the New Testament. I hope you can do some of that yourself. The future history of the tent and the covenant chest, very interesting, difficult to follow through. They're not there in the New Testament. What you have is not Solomon's temple, not even the replacement. You've got Herod's reconstruction. And what we're left with today is the flat platform that Herod had put in place. Nothing else. But when Jesus in Mark 11, 5-6 days before he was crucified, walked into the courtyard, walked into the outer courtyard, you've got the priests in the central courtyard. Barrier behind them and outside the barrier, the men of Israel. A barrier behind them and outside the barrier, the women of Israel. A barrier behind them and outside the barrier, foreigners who wanted to follow the God of Israel. It was all barriers. And Jesus comes and chases the traders out. My house should be a house of prayer for all nations. It's symbolic, isn't it? He's just about to start bringing nations. But the barriers have all gone. One of the surest signs of that is that when he died, the temple curtain is ripped. To let us in? Well, yes, to let us in. But there's, you know, I'm a foreigner. I'm not a Jew. I can't get past the first barrier on pain of death. Or you're a woman. You can get past the next barrier, but that's as far as you can go. Or you're a man of Israel, and you can go by the next barrier. But unless you're from Levi, you can't go where God is. So the only ones who knew about that curtain being torn must have been the priests, eh? And they told the news back out. Stephen saw it. Time for all that's gone. Paul saw it in Corinth. He said, don't you know that you are the temple of the Holy Spirit? He lives in you. Now there's the movement of God's house. From a tent in the wilderness of Sinai, with all the work that went into it, eventually God's got to where he wants to be, not just among his people, in his people. Now there's movement for you. And that's not the end of the story, is it? I'm going to have to stop. Who plays the closing song?